I'd like now to welcome to the program James Burley. He's a retired plant scientist from California State University at Chico. And tomorrow, Thursday, February 24th, from 6 to 7:30, he will be talking on the subject of food security for emerging countries at the O'Keefe Museum Education Annex at 123 Grant Avenue here in Santa Fe. And it's part of the Santa Fe Alliance for Science Cafe for Young Thinkers. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So what, first of all, do we mean by food security?
The ability of individuals, and therefore of countries, to have sustainable production so that all members of a family are able to feed themselves adequately with volume as well as proper nutrition.
And so emerging countries, what are they emerging from? What do we mean by that term?
Let me back up for just a moment. The French, bless their hearts, had an interesting phrase that they would use to refer to developing countries, les pays en voie de développement, the countries that are in the process of developing. Now they refer to them as les pays émergents, emerging countries, emerging from the doldrums of poverty. And that seems to be a more acceptable phrase in today's parlance than developing countries was some years ago.
And third world countries before that and so on.
That's correct. That's correct.
Okay, so they're emerging. When I think of that term, I just think emerging from the slime.
No.
The primordial ooze.
Emerging in their capacity to satisfy the needs of individuals.
And so when we have countries that have basically a larger population than they can support food-wise, what happens and what is the role of developed countries, or whatever they're, emerged countries, whatever they're called, in helping them out?
Well, surely population growth has been and will continue to be an issue that has to be faced. But it is a very sensitive issue in certain parts of the world, and one that I won't try to deal with. And so the second part of your question has, what do you do? Now, what does a country do when it has individuals who are not capable of producing enough? Well, you produce more. And how do you produce more? Well, that requires certain infrastructure. Does the country have an infrastructure? Does it have individuals, institutions that are capable of addressing the issues, the production issues that a country faces? And so a lot of America's efforts in the past, you know, have been directed to building institutions. That's no longer the case, Mary Charlotte. But 20-some years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, even 50 years ago, that was the primary emphasis of America's efforts in taking technology to India, to Pakistan, to various countries in North Africa, Central Africa, and East Africa. Now,
what types of institutions?
Agricultural universities or institutes of agriculture. You know, for example, I worked at the Institut Agronomique et Veterinaire in Rabat, Morocco for 7 years. This was an institute that trained individuals up to the equivalent of American master's degree in various disciplines in all areas of agriculture as well as in engineering. And it was the notion that by helping that institution grow, therefore by helping individuals, the faculty members, increase their capabilities in research and development, the country itself could help itself. And if you take a look at Morocco today, in contrast to when I went there initially in 1978, you do see a marked improvement in wealth in the countryside as well as in cities. And so that the building of that institute, IAV, Institut Agronomique et Veterinaire, the project was able to to do what it said it was going to do.
And yet that's no longer the policy?
It's no longer the practice of USAID. USAID, that was probably the... They had given a contract to the University of Minnesota. And the University of Minnesota operated that contract from 1970, 1971 until 1991. The projects that USAID currently funds are in more soundbite forms and may have to do with very specific accomplishments rather than building an institution. When you say you're building an institution, that means you're talking about people. You're not building a dam, which you can see, and you know when you start and you know when you finish. When you're building an institution, you're building a capacity for that institution to deal with the food issues that a country faces. And those are only going to be faced by individuals who have the capacity, the intellectual capacity, as well as the financial means to research those needs and to find ways of meeting them.
So it sounds like the former way of doing things had to do with building self-sufficiency.
Yes.
Both food self-sufficiency and the intellectual and institutional self-sufficiency to deal with whatever food or other problems came up.
That is accurate. Today, I only know what I read about USAID. I mean, it's been years since I was a contractor with them, and I can't speak too loudly about the nature of the work that they do. But there's more billions of dollars being spent now than there was two decades ago. But the money that is spent has to do, yes, with increasing the sustainability of production, increasing the sustainability of institutions. But it has ceased to build institutions with long-term commitments to an institution so that it goes through its birthing pangs as well as its teenage years and matures. That is not the general practice any longer of the United States' approach to development.
And so how would you characterize it? What are we as a nation now trying to do to help food insecure nations?
This may sound like I'm trying to avoid your question, but spreading democracy is a primary objective, and within that general umbrella of democracy, if countries are friends of the United States, they will find that projects that may be put forward by individuals within the country for increasing production in one form or another will in fact be funded. But the United States, if I say its efforts are not always altruistic, that shouldn't be a surprise to anyone.
Well, when I hear the word spreading democracy, my detectors go up very, very quickly. BS detectors.
Well, certainly,
to be clear.
At one time, when USAID was first created in 1961, it was an independent agency. It was not associated with the State Department. That was changed some years ago, but I can't tell you exactly when. So now the Secretary of State is the person in charge of USAID, even though there is a director for USAID. But it was not under the aegis of the State Department initially, whereas now it is. And what does the State Department want to do? Well, people will have various opinions on that.
Right.
But certainly they want to spread democracy, you know, and they want to spread the American way of doing things around the globe, and they make efforts to do that. Now, the institutions, the countries, rather, that receive the largesse of Americans' foreign development funds are what countries? I mean, that's historically it's been Egypt, it's been Pakistan, it's been Israel. You know, for different reasons, But those are the three elephants in the park, you know, that have received the lion's share of America's foreign development aid. There are many other countries, you know, through Peace Corps, through contracts that have been given to various companies to work on specific projects in countries, you know, where America's money goes, your tax dollar and mine goes.
Now, there is always this question when it comes to U.S. foreign policy about whether it is in the U.S. interest for other nations to be truly self-sufficient versus being just economically self-sufficient enough to buy our products.
Yes. How do I respond to that? At one time, and it may still be a program within the United States, it had a program called PL-480. Public Law 480 was passed decades ago. And what it was is that the excess of American wheat, corn production, was so many millions of metric tons were given to countries who could then sell that on the open market and fund some of their own projects. I don't know for sure, but I believe PL 480 still operates. But right now, and there has been since about 2008, you know, a real concern that those products, which in fact had been almost in excess, like the principal cereals that people consume, rice, wheat, and corn, much of which comes from the United States, that those foreign markets were essential, you know, to the American economy. Well, if you look at the price now on the Chicago Commodity Stock Exchange, you know, you'll see that those products are very high priced, and countries cannot afford to purchase them. And the American farmer is laughing all the way to the bank, you know, because of the prices that she receives.
You are a plant scientist. Maybe we should talk a little bit about actually the kind of work that you do.
I would feel far more comfortable, Mary Charlotte, in that realm than what you've asked me so far.
Well, what has been the nature of your work as a plant scientist working abroad? You've worked in Egypt. You've worked in the Philippines and other places.
Yes, true. And in all of those, the countries from Morocco to Rwanda to Sri Lanka to the Philippines to Egypt to Nepal to Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan. I don't know if I have them all or not.
That's
a lot. In April, it will be Mali. All has been directed towards improving the capacity of growers to produce. I haven't dealt with markets, which is an important consideration. I haven't dealt with economics, which is an important consideration. Except the information that I sent you about grafted tomato production in the Philippines, of course, economics was a principal part of that work. And it only has achieved some success because the economics work in favor of being able to produce tomato when tomatoes are not normally produced in central Luzon because of flooding and hurricanes that come through. So economics is very important, but my personal work has dealt with production.
And so let's talk about tomatoes for a moment. When you go to a place to help them increase their tomato production, what kind of basic problems, just on a botany tomato growing level, do you see?
Well, let's start with the Philippines, and then I'll go to Egypt, if I may, please. I spent several years in the Philippines, but only a matter of weeks in Egypt, over 3 years, but a much shorter period of time. The Philippines is a very diverse country, agriculturally, ethnically, socially. And it suffers, as much of Southeast Asia does, you know, from periodic hurricanes, which can flood large areas and make agriculture impossible, but, you know, for a period of time. If tomato is flooded, in 3 days it's dead, and you have to start all over again. By grafting the tomato onto eggplant roots, we were able to show, you know, that in fact farmers could have their crop flooded for 3 days, 4 days, and the plant would survive, which meant that they could produce tomatoes during what is referred to there as the off-season, that is from late May, June, until December. That is the period of time in central Luzon in the Philippines that is subject to sometimes severe hurricanes. And when tomatoes, an important source of vitamin C, an important source of vitamin A, are not grown, and farmers know that they can't grow it during that time. If they could, then the price of the tomato some years ago when I was there was about 20 pesos a kilo. 50 pesos equaled $1. Whereas during the hot, dry season, the Philippines doesn't have a cool season. It's either hot, dry, or it's hot and wet. So during the hot, dry season, when folks are growing tomatoes by the bushel full, they sell for 2 pesos a kilo. So if the farmer had the capacity of growing tomatoes during this period of time when tomatoes are not commonly grown, then he would have added income, and the folks who live in such large cities as Manila, you know, with 12 million plus people, you know, would have an additional source of vitamin and nutrition. And so we introduced that technology to a number of growers in central Luzon, and thanks to some folks who are still there, you know, Filipino scientists, are pushing that practice. And it is, if I say it, it's growing in, I can't really say that because I don't know for sure, because I've long since lost track of the spread of that technology among additional growers. But it did work, and farmers made money, if you remember from reading that article, that some farmers did, some farmers did not. But those who did not, we knew why they did not. And they did not make money because they didn't do what we had suggested they should do.
Right.
And so if they follow the rubrics of the technology, they would make money.
Now, you have in some of your work discussed reasons why the very best plans that you lay out for other people don't work. There are things as simple as language barriers.
Surely, and some of those language barriers I'm probably not aware of. In the Philippines, for example, most folks will speak English, and so communication is not a difficult matter. In Egypt, the other country where I've worked with tomatoes, I have to have a translator. Now, is that translator sufficiently well-versed in agriculture, the agricultural sciences, so that he or she can translate the concepts that I'm talking about accurately? And the short answer is, I don't know for sure. But I always give a translator several pages of terms and their definitions weeks in advance, so that individual will have a chance to go through those terms that I would commonly use, not with growers, unless they were American growers, but so that that individual will be able to translate the concepts into, in this case, Arabic. Now, yes, I know a little bit of Arabic, but it's so little as to be almost worthless.
What was the nature of your work with tomato farmers in Egypt?
To identify specific plant diseases that may be impediments to yield, and teach farmers and technicians how to identify those diseases and what they should do in order to combat and slow down rates of development of diseases. Tomato farmers in Egypt have a notion that they are plagued with a number of different diseases in what is referred to as Upper Egypt, which is south, almost to Sudan. Whereas my observations suggest that they don't have the problem they think they have. And so what do they look at? You know, they look at their leaves, they look at their stems, they don't look at their roots, and they see a spot, and they think, therefore, I need to put on some pesticide, sulfur, or a copper compound. And my observations have been such that I think that's totally a waste of their money and a waste of time, and they don't need to do it. I'm not opposed to them putting on pesticides of one sort or another if it is warranted. But if it is not warranted, you know, then they're wasting their time and their money. And so the nature of what I was doing was developing a key, you know, like you go through a dichotomous key. Are the lesions on the leaves or on the stems or on the fruit? Okay, I make that decision. Then if they're on, are they circular, are they angular, etc.? And so one could, by following different steps in descending order, you can come to the proper identification. With some, I should hasten to say that with some diseases don't lend themselves to that approach to identification. You need a biochemical approach. But then there are tests that technicians can learn to use, and we are trying to show technicians with a virus disease, for example, you know, how can you determine which virus is causing the problem? And if there is a virus, or whether it's just the imagination of the grower himself, herself.
Now, this sounds like a perfect example of where if there were an institution like a school of agriculture in that region, people wouldn't have to rely on a non-Arabic speaking big guy from the U.S. coming over and telling them how to do their jobs.
Yes. But then you're getting into another side of it that is the more human side. There are institutions. There are institutions in Upper Egypt, in Aswan. Yeah, in Aswan, there is a university. And there are people there who are well trained. Then the next question is, well, why aren't they doing this work out? And they do not have the financial resources to move. I mean, Egypt's a huge country. And if you go down to Aswan and if you head west, you go through one of the biggest kitty litter boxes in the world. And it's all sand. And then you find where there is irrigation, they're able to grow crops of one sort or another. And they will grow tomatoes because the production of tomatoes is being pushed in the country currently. But those scientists do not have the means to move readily and often.
And the people from the United States do.
And the folks that I do some volunteer work with, I'm a volunteer, so I'm cheap. But the organization that sends me, there's been two. One is called Winrock International from Little Rock, Arkansas. And the other is ACDI VOCA, V-O-C-A. I've asked what that acronym means and nobody's ever told me. I'm assuming it's a legitimate organization. But they get their money from USAID for what is called a farmer-to-farmer program. And it takes old retired folks like me and says, okay, you have a certain expertise in an area, in this case, plant diseases. We think that you can be of a help here. And so they will send me to Nepal, to Egypt, to Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, blah, blah, go on, the other stands. And there you attempt to help people solve problems and to make their production more sustainable.
James Burley is a retired plant scientist from California State University at Chico. And once again, tomorrow, Thursday, February 24th, from 6 to 7:30, he will lead a student discussion on food security for emerging countries. It's at the Georgia O'Keeffe Education Annex at 123 Grant Avenue. It's part of the Santa Fe Alliance for Science Cafe for Young Thinkers series. As always, admission is free, and light refreshments will be served. Thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.